You're listening to North Atlantic Radio with your hosts, Brian Zuda and Matt Rigott.
So, welcome to the podcast, episode 9. Brian and I have just finished...
10. What? 10. Isn't it 10?
Is it?
I think.
Are you sure?
Maybe I'm... No.
Well, this will go to show how well researched this is. We don't even remember our own episode numbers.
Radio.com.
Welcome to episode 9 or 10. Brian and I have just finished recording this episode. Spent the last half hour on the phone talking nerd. How'd you think it went, Brian?
Pretty well. A few starts and stops. But again, we're not spectacularly professional on our over North Atlantic Skyping connection.
Yeah, so. The Skype connection gets worse and progressively more worse and worse as we record. So I end up not being able to hear a word Brian says. A bit like old age, I guess. It's getting me ready for being 60 or 70. But yeah, I think it went well. Once again, we've talked way too much, way more than we need to, so we'll cut it out to just the purest 15 minutes of fun. So enjoy.
It is episode 9. Ever since the US started data.gov, a lot of other countries like New Zealand and the UK are all starting to fall in line and realize that government and open data and transparency is really a good thing. And there's been quite a lot of interesting projects that have been popping up around this. And we just want to talk a little bit about some of these and highlight them, as well as further discuss why open data is an interesting thing, and hopefully other places that we can see open data, government data emerging soon.
Yeah, data.gov is the one that kicked it all off. There's one coming out from the UK government in the next few months, probably the beginning of 2010. Have we decided how you say that yet? 2010, 2010?
I don't know. I put a zero in front of everything anyway. So.
which is, people are calling data.gov.uk, but I don't know if that's going to be the domain name. The UK government have got Tim Berners-Lee involved. He's at very least involved at a high level, but possibly even running the whole thing. So it's going to be fantastic. To see what comes out of that. I think it's going to be really, really good. And there's been a few kind of sneak peeks at it. There's a company called Newspaper Club, who they're a startup, and it's their idea to allow people to print off newspapers in small runs without the extraordinary costs that would normally involve. So you could do 200, a run of 200 papers for your local area or whatever, and put it through everyone's letterbox, and it shouldn't cost you the world, but at the same time you should be able to do a really, really professional job with it. And they were invited to a private beta of data.gov.uk, and they'd use the APIs that this service is going to offer to get to make up what they called a local newspaper, where it's something that you get perhaps from the government when you move into your house and you pay your first council tax, which is property tax in the UK. The council know that the person who owns the house has changed, so they send you this newspaper, and it comes through, and you get just fantastic things like a list of the local amenities, like where the nearest allotments, what's the crime level like, has it gone down, has it gone up, who's your councillor.
I think it's walking distance to bus stations and tube stations.
Tube stations and undergrounds and train stations, adult education, healthcare, is your hospital good or is it bad, and so on. And it, not only is that, it would be a great thing to kind of feel a bit more like you're getting a personal service from the council, but it's genuinely useful information, and they've really thought about how to display that data. So that's just a really, really nice project. And as well, the Newspaper Club, I think, Brian, you're as excited as I am about...
Oh, that's an incredible idea.
...what we're going to be able to do with this. They're still in private beta as well at the moment, but I know they're planning a public beta somewhere soon. But, this brings us on... I think this is probably something we bang on and on about on the podcast, and just talking, stopping people in the street to tell them about this, but government and open data. Government have huge amounts of data. Some of it would be incredibly useful. We've mentioned before postcodes created public money in the UK, but you have to pay to use them. Doesn't really make sense. You've got ordnance.
OpenStreetMaps.
OpenStreetMaps here. Ordnance Survey is the UK government's mapping agency, paid for by taxpayers' money, but if you're on the maps, you've got to pay for them. Paper maps, that's understandable because it costs to produce, but...
Recently, there was a great quote passed through my RSS reader, and for the life of me, I can't remember who or where I saw it, but they said a map isn't truly open until you can have it printed on a cake. And it's just kind of one of those things, you know, you get all these crappy, you know, cakes with anything you want, but if there's no royalties needed to print your map on a cake, then you know it's truly open.
Right. I'm probably going to backtrack slightly on what I've just said, actually, because when I was going to say, because something's printed, because they print the map, you have to pay for it, but obviously there's costs involved in putting it online. But the point is that UK, the government agents, mapping agencies are paid for by tax money, so why then they should be able to treat their maps as kind of proprietary data that they can sell on to the public is a little hard to understand. And there's been people, you know, making these complaints to higher levels. And it seems actually breaking news within the last hour as we speak. Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister of the UK, is going to give a speech setting out how some Ordnance Survey data will be free to use. Next, heroes and villains. We'll start with the heroes. My hero this week is a company called Amanita Design, based somewhere in the Czech Republic. They produce this fantastic point-and-click game called Machinarium. It's built in Flash, so there's a demo online. You can play the first three or four screens of the game, and it's just brilliant. The music is fantastic. The graphics are just gorgeous. And the gameplay is really, really, really... you can't stop playing it. You can't get away from it. And it's a great little game. Even the characters are wonderfully designed. And, you know, you really get stuck in the game. So we'll put the link on in the show notes. But machinarium.net/demo, you can play it. And if you like it, the full game costs like 15 quid or something like that. And it's well worth having a look into. So thank you, Amanita Design, for... producing such a fantastic little game.
Yeah, I guess my hero of the week is going to be NASA for their debunking of this 2012 end of the world, this whole meme that's running around. The movie was released last weekend or a couple days ago. I don't know, whenever this actually gets out on the net, it was released
recently,
mid-November, and it took a huge box office. Millions and millions, and everyone is assuming that the Mayan calendar is pointing to the end of the world at 2012, and because the Earth is going to do all this weird stuff. And I think most of the Mayans are like, your calendar doesn't end December 31st, so you know your world doesn't end at the end of your year. You know, the world's not going to end at 2012, but people get caught up in the buzz, and so NASA has got a whole FAQs debunking the fact that the world is not going to end in 2012, so they're my hero for standing up to ignorance and trying to make the world a better place.
Yeah, good on NASA. It's pretty kind of hitting the head against a brick wall, though, because once 2012 comes and goes and we're all still here, there'll be some other discovery of a calendar that's finishing or some prophecy, and people will just latch onto that, and it'll just start all over again.
Yeah, well, I guess you could, our tax dollars that are paying for this debunking, I guess maybe you could chalk that up to education fund. So, yeah, I mean, the same thing happened in Y2K, and it didn't end then, and 2012 is even more of a mythical thing, and it's not going to end, so. But on to villains. Who's your villain this week, Matt?
My villain is Adobe. It comes back to open data. Surprise, surprise. We've only not been speaking about that for about 2 minutes. We mentioned data.gov, the US government's website where they're putting up as much data that's really available and free to use as they can. And Adobe clearly thought, oh, that looks quite good. We should have a bit of that, probably make some money from that. And so they've come up with, they're desperately trying to get people to believe that using Flash and PDF for open data is a good idea. And it's just been strongly debunked by the people who have to deal with this stuff. People who have been getting MPs' expenses receipts as scanned in PDFs, or bills that have passed through the US Congress and getting them as PDFs. Worse, they've had them as they were originally XML documents and they've been converted to PDFs, and this is the data they get. And PDFs, Flash even more so, is just so unusable for this. There's nothing wrong with data being given to people as a PDF as a secondary thing, but when you get PDFs or Flash as the first point that you get this data, you just lose. Well, you can't, if it's in a browser, Flash, you can't copy and paste text, you can't increase or decrease the font size so it's more or less, it's more readable. You can't use your browser searching, you can't necessarily use keyboards. The data cannot be parsed or scraped in any way. The design's fixed width. I mean, these are just incredibly easy problems to overcome. They've been overcome yet and again and again. HTML, XML, there are plenty of formats where this data would just be brilliantly available in non-proprietary, open format that people know how to parse and deal with. And Adobe, purely for reasons of profit, have decided that it shouldn't be this way, and they're trying to lobby to get people to believe otherwise. So they're my villains for just not doing the right thing.
My villains, different company, but a lot of the same reasons. Verizon had the opportunity to release this new Android phone called Droid, which in itself is a bit of a bizarre thing. If you've seen the Droid commercials, if not, we'll link to one. They're trying to slag off the iPhone, saying all the things that Droid can do that the iPhone can't. And then at the end, it goes into this really, really creepy, like, Seven the movie ad for the Droid phone. And, you know, up until that point, you were like, oh, this could be a nice phone. But needless to say, Verizon finally came out with some of their pricing schemes. And sure enough, you know, the phone is not going to be cheap. You're going to need a two-year contract, but that's no different than buying an iPhone. But now they've started to really nickel and dime their potential user base to the point where it's not even economical to use the phone. It's, let's see, $50 for each additional gigabyte over the 5 gigabyte limit on data plan, $30 a month unlimited data. There's like a $15 fee if you want to tether. It's just, all of a sudden, your standard monthly phone bill goes up, you know, $60-$75 just to use it in a smartphone type way. So they're my villain because they had an opportunity to really kind of come at the iPhone and bring some competition into the market, but they've just gotten greedy and priced themselves out of it. I thought of one more thing, both about the government open data and the villains, your Adobe thing. And I don't know how to work it in, but we've got loads of things we can't do because of data protection. So even though we might want open data for everything, there's going to be obviously privacy issues, which is why like the UK won't give you the raw data for the surveys. This like because you know, minorities make this amount of money in this postcode. Well, there's two minority families.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The if you've got a when a census goes down to a ward level, and you've only got say one black person within that ward, then they have to you have to hide that census information. You can't give that census information out because that would personally identify someone. But in the UK, I think they do it where they just simply don't release that data set, rather than not giving you all the data. Which is, it's a fair compromise because, yeah, you have to protect the individual's privacy. So we finish off with this week's books. Fewer than usual. I've only got one and Brian's only got one as well. We've obviously been slacking, or Brian's been slacking. I'm always slacking with my books anyway. But my book this week, I finished the Time Traveler's Guide to Medieval England, which I was talking about in the last podcast. Absolutely brilliant. Couldn't put that book down. Really, really enjoyed it. And then I get occasional obsessions with silly things. And my current obsession is all the prime ministers of Great Britain and the UK the last 250 years or whatever. And I've just been reading up more and more on them. So I just picked up, I thought I'd choose one at random, one of the lesser known ones, and pick up a biography of him. So I've picked up and I've started reading The Forgotten Prime Minister, the 14th Earl of Derby, by Angus Hawkins, which is about Prime Minister, I think it was Prime Minister three times in the middle of the 19th century. And it's probably the most boring book I've ever read. It's just lists of stuff that he does. It's not a novel. I was hoping for a bit of colour, but it's quite boring. So I'll probably flick through that and pick up a few nuggets of information about him, and then move on to something more interesting.
I doubt you'll even be able to use any of those nuggets of information, even at some pub quiz.
Yeah, exactly. I want a bit of pub quiz information, and then I can pretend I've finished it.
The book that I picked up, I just bought this book a week or two ago. It's called Iron Fists, Branding in the 21st Century. Oh, it's totalitarian. Yeah, it's branding in the 20th century totalitarian state. And it's really, really interesting. Because my background is more in computer programming and everything. But this book outlines basically the sort of brand management for the Germans, Nazis in World War II, Stalin and the communists, the fascists, and then the Chinese, Mao, and the Little Red Book. And it's really, really interesting how they were down to which font they were going to use and arguing about this and that and centralized control. And it's just a really, really fascinating insight into, brand management and sort of, I guess, that fine line between patriotism and fascism, nationalism. So all in the form of war posters and propaganda.
That sounds really good. Are you far through it yet?
I finished the Nazis and I finished the fascists and I'm about halfway
through
Stalin.
You finished the Nazis? I thought that was
Stalinists.
The British and Americans in the Second World War.
You couldn't put them down. They made a book. But yeah, it's a bit weird. I mean, it comes in like a weird dust jacket because the cover is some, early Nazi party handbook, which probably shouldn't leave laying around on the coffee table. But so they give you a nice dust jacket. But I could talk for ages about this. I mean, I'm really interested in brand management and branding. And I've got a few little projects here and there on the go. And I always want to know, if I can do things better. And this is just a look into things gone way too good sometimes.
And there we go, 15 minutes of fun already over. We worked out it is episode 9. You said it's episode 9, didn't you, Brian?
It is 9. After looking at the website, northatlanticradio.com.
That was episode 9. Episode 10 coming up next month. So you can look forward to that. Bye.